committee, and we're going to open the work session on House Bill 2757. And would the administrator briefly tell us what we're looking at here?
Sure. Chair Starr, members of the committee, House Bill 2757 limits the eligibility to vote on the question of formation of a new county to electors registered within the limits of the proposed new county. We have discussion previously about this and how it might pertain to cities such as Gresham.
As Chair, we're in work session. I'm going to provide a courtesy vote on this bill, and I would move House Bill 2757 to the floor due pass.
Senator Bryant has moved House Bill 2757 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Bryant?
Aye.
Senator Adams?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2757 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We will you will have chair carrying that bill. H.C.R. 28, companion bill.
Hmm?
Open the work session on H.C.R. 28.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, H.C.R. 28. Again, we have previous discussion on this. And upon voter approval at the next special or primary election, this would amend the Oregon Constitution to allow creation of a new county less than 400 square miles in size from land of an existing county as long as the new county has a population of at least 100,000 people.
Mr. Chair, as a courtesy, I'll provide the vote on this today, and I would move H.J.R. 28 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Bryant has moved H.J.R. 28 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call it. Roll.
Senator Adams.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, H.D.R. 28, food court, due pass. Chair will carry. Let's see. We're going to jump to Object 3617. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3617. Mr. Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, just real briefly, House Bill 3617 is a bill that passed out of the House and is over in the Senate. This provides a check mark on your tax return forms to allow money that would be returned traditionally as the kicker to be sent back to the school fund to be distributed to schools throughout the state of Oregon. We looked at distributing it to individual school districts of people, but there was too difficult a problem in doing that to the Revenue Department and too big a fiscal impact. We feel that this will help resolve some of the kicker-related debate that continues to bog down this legislature year after year. I'd be open to any questions.
Any questions of our representative?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, are we in work session? Not yet, but we're going to close the public hearing, open the work session on House Bill 3617.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3617 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Adams has moved House Bill 3617 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Adams?
Aye.
Senator Bryant?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye. I receive the necessary majority. House Bill 3617 and move the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I would carry it if you'd like.
And Senator Bryant will carry. Thank you very much. Appreciate your
Mr. Chair, I'm going to return to Ways and Means then, but I shall return later when you need.
All right. Oh, appreciate that.
Thank you.
We go back to the top of the agenda. That's Senator Yee is here for what? 3606? All right, we will take that one out of order. And next on the agenda, we open a public hearing on House Bill 3606. And we have signed up for that. And we are in a subcommittee of the Rules Election Committee to take public testimony. And we got May Yi, would you tell us why we need to have this bill, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm State Senator May Yi, representing Senate District 19, which is comprised of portions of Lane and Benton counties. Thank you for taking me out of order. I have to go back to Ways and Means full committee, and they met 15 minutes ago. I'm here to support House Bill 3606, of which I'm a co-sponsor. In late 1998, the Environmental Protection Agency promulgated the cluster rules, which are environmental mandates for pulp mills across the nation. These rules require installation of additional environmental control equipment at pulp mills at great expense within a very short time frame. At the same time, the pulp industry worldwide is in a deep slowdown with very few mills making a profit. I have such a mill in my district, Hope and Talbot's Halsey installation. They're faced with a $35 million expenditure for these environmental upgrades, which must be completed by year 2001. Passage of House Bill 3606 will enable Hope and Talbot to trade or sell pollution control tax credits to a third party who would finance, construct, and or own the facility under a sale leaseback arrangement. Unfortunately, at this time, Hope and Talbot is one of those companies which have shown no profit at this mill in the past few years. They lost $17 million in 1998. At the same time, passage of 3606 would allow for outside financing that in turn will be done at a much less cost to the company and the third party as well. This is a company that employs more than 200 people in blue-collar jobs, paying an average of $74,000 per year. Additionally, more than 700 jobs are held by people who work for companies who serve as vendors for Pope and Talbot. Loss of these jobs because of a forced mill shutdown would be disastrous for Linn County, which already has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state, not to mention the loss of income taxes these people presently pay to the state. Also lost will be property taxes paid by the company. This scenario faces a company that has been an environmental leader in Oregon, having helped organize and finance the recent Willamette River study, which I helped sponsor 9 years ago for 6 years. The company's plant is already the most environmentally advanced operation in the Northwest, if not the entire West, with incoming industries being granted immense tax breaks to settle in Oregon. It just seems fair that a long-time Oregon company and industry could be given an opportunity to finance environmental upgrades mandated by a federal agency in a way that would be least onerous financially, as well as saving hundreds of well-paying jobs. And I urge this committee's support of House Bill 3606 and respectfully request that you move it to the Senate and House for the due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Invite Jack McKay, Isaac, Mike Flannery, Pat Whittington.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jack McIsaac, and I'm here with the president of Pope and Talbot and the director of taxes of Pope and Talbot to voice our support for House Bill 3606. Mr. Flannery has the formal presentation, so he can take it from here.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Mike Flannery. I'm the President and Chief Operating Officer of Pope and Talbot. We're located in Portland, Oregon, where our headquarters are. We operate this pulp mill in Halsey, Oregon, and we also operate several sawmills in the U.S. and in Canada. I'm here today to support this House Bill 3606, which would enable Bleachcraft pulp and paper mills in the state to use a common method of financing known as the sale and leaseback system. And this would finance the construction of large-scale pollution facilities in this case. In a sale and leaseback process, a company sells a facility to an investor and then leases it back to operate the business itself. The current law already provides that certain recycling facilities to use the sale and leaseback system, and this bill would extend that treatment to Bleachcraft pulp and paper mills. The American Can Company built our Halsey Mill in 1968, and it's the newest mill of its kind west of the Mississippi. Pope and Talbot became a partner in the mill in 1978, and then we became the sole owner in 1983. We paid slightly under $40 million, the original purchase price of the mill. And since then, we've invested more than $40 million already in pollution control equipment. The mill, as mentioned earlier by the Senator Yee, is one of the most environmentally advanced mills in the world. We have an excellent record of compliance with pollution control laws, and we're very proud of our record of working cooperatively with the federal and state environmental authorities. We also took the lead, as she mentioned, in gathering financial and technical support for the Willamette River study earlier this decade. Pollution control tax credits were enacted by the legislature here in Oregon in 1967 to encourage environmental expenditures by existing businesses in the state and to attract new industry. These tax credits enable companies to recover about 50% of their environmental improvements through tax reductions. And over the years, these credits have helped to bring and keep many industries in the state of Oregon. When pulp mills earn taxable incomes, these credits are very useful. Unfortunately, EPA and the other federal and state agencies have imposed new requirements even during low points in our industry's business cycle. The pulp industry is now in a worldwide downturn, which has gone on for the better part of 3 years. In addition, our industry must compete with pulp producers that are in other parts of the world that are not nearly as protective of the environment as we are here in the United States. In 1998, our company lost nearly $17 million and continues to lose money this year at Halsey. In fact, last year was the first time that our Halsey mill experienced any downtime of any consequence due to market conditions, and we're proud of the fact that we've been a very consistent employer in the state. We do expect that an upward phase of the business cycle is ahead of us, but in the meantime, we're unable to use the tax credit, and we face an EPA-mandated deadline shortly for installing this pollution facility. This bill will help level out the effects of the business cycle for Bleachcraft pulp and paper companies, because outside investors who invest in the control facilities will be allowed to claim that credit. Those investors can use the credit and, in effect, pass the credit back to the company in the form of lower cost of funds. The intent of the original legislation stays the same, which is to lower the cost of installing pollution control equipment. The recently issued cluster rules of the EPA require that Bleachcraft pulp mills, like our Halsey mill, install new equipment by 2001 or face federally mandated shutdowns. For Pope and Talbot, this means installing another $35 million of worth of equipment in addition to the $49 we spent earlier. The new pollution control equipment must be installed by 2001 or the EPA will not allow the mill to operate. The jobs of more than 200 of our employees are thus in jeopardy, and the average wage and benefits of these jobs is around $74,000 a year. In addition to those jobs, we estimate that there are 800 jobs that depend indirectly on the Halsey Mill, which would be lost to the state. Linn County would lose property taxes of around $500,000 a year from the mill alone, and Oregon would lose around $800,000 a year in income taxes paid by our employees. The property tax revenues would decline in Linn, Benton, and Lane counties as workers left to find other jobs. And all in all, we believe that the Halsey Mill generates much more in tax revenues than the amount of tax credits involved. Tax credits that we believe we already benefit from if the industry went on a downturn. We strongly feel that the bill is revenue neutral to the state. The pollution control tax credit statute is not being extended by this bill, and this bill does not provide tax credits beyond those available in the current law. House Bill 3606 allows companies to continue to be environmentally responsible in a negative economy. Pope and Talbot and others in our industry have existed in the state for many years and have grown with the state, and we have contributed to the welfare of Oregon citizens through corporate participation, attractive wages, and by paying our share of taxes. We believe that this bill will contribute and help companies like ours to continue to contribute to Oregon's prosperity. And I urge you to pass Bill 3606 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Separate from my written comments, I'd just like to make a few other parenthetical remarks, if I may. First, these credits do exist for a reason, and that is to attract and retain industry and jobs in the state. The bleached craft pulp industry, and I speak particularly for pulp and Talbot states, needs these credits considering the regulations that are being imposed on us. Pulp and Talbot will have spent more on pollution control equipment with no economic return than the balance of the productive capacity we spent on the mill since we've owned it. Our pulp mill is at best a low-return facility from an investment viewpoint, and it is great reluctance that Pope and Talbot even makes this investment without the help of these credits, even with the help of these credits. Without the credits, our board of directors will have a very difficult time agreeing to do this. Closure would follow with a very large negative effect on the economic health of the region and a very large negative impact on the state's income, as I mentioned earlier. There are currently actually a number of facilities, some of the Halsey elsewhere in the United States, specifically in the South, in Mobile, Alabama, owned by Kimberly-Clark, and in Maine, a mill in Westbrook, Maine, owned by Sappi, where their boards have faced similar pollution expenditure decisions but chose to close those pulp mills rather than invest in the required pollution equipment. The Oregon has also recently suffered the loss of the International Paper Linerboard Mill in Gardner, Oregon, which reduced the market for sawmill chips in the region, and Halsey plays a very similar role for the local wood products industry purchasing their chips and sawdust byproducts. The ripple effect of a closure, I know, will affect them quite substantially also. This financing alternative for Pope and Talbot is very important, as the company will have to borrow money to install this equipment.
Excuse me, we've got a little bit of a problem.
Thank you.
I'm the time restraint here. We've got the votes to move the bill. We've got a witness in opposition. Any questions, sir?
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate very much the position you're in, and certainly appreciate having this truck before us. Hillary Abraham. Be brief. You've heard my admonition already.
Yes.
Do you have the votes to move the bill?
Yes.
We have your written testimony. Thank you for being here to present, make your case.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Hillary Abraham with the Oregon Environmental Council, and I will try and make my comments brief. I would like to be on record saying that the Oregon Environmental Council is opposed to House Bill 3606. We believe that pollution control tax credit may have made sense 30 years ago, but it no longer does today. We have several concerns about this bill. Specifically, we feel that by allowing Pope and Talbot to transfer their credits to any other institution, the bill will primarily set a dangerous precedent for expanding fixed credits. This goes in the opposite direction of the recommendations of the Governor's Task Force, of which OEC was a member, which recommended narrowing the availability of the pollution control tax credit. The equipment acquired by Pope and Talbot under the leaseback agreement will bring Pope and Talbot into compliance with federal law requirements, which apply to every pulp mill in the nation. This is a subsidy which does nothing to encourage Pope and Talbot or any other business to go above and beyond what is required by law. The leaseback agreement will also be giving the tax credit to leasees that the pulp that Pope and Talbot chooses. Oregon taxpayers could wind up sending tax credits to California, Canada, or Taiwan. The bill has a significant fiscal impact as well. Oregonians could end up subsidizing Pope and Talbot by approximately $17 million. While we support businesses that provide good jobs for Oregonians, we don't think Oregon taxpayers should have to foot the bill for compliance with federal laws. Finally, ending the pollution control tax credit could cover the cost of expanding tax breaks for working Oregonians, who certainly need the relief more than our largest businesses do. In a time when we are trying to find scarce dollars to fund our schools, our prisons, and other core government services, can we really afford to subsidize big businesses to comply with the law? And with that, I'll close and answer any questions.
Questions of the witness. Well, I appreciate very much your concern. It is my concern that we have placed these burdens by government regulation on businesses. And unless they have some relief, we lose important jobs, important revenue. And this bill has a very important public policy issue at its heart. And for that reason, I am going to be urging my members to support moving the bill forward. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing, open work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3606.
Needs to vote on Ways and
Means. Do Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Adams has moved that House Bill 3606 be moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Adams?
Aye.
Senator Byer?
Aye.
Senator Stone?
Aye. I receive the necessary majority. House Bill 3606 moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. I thank you very much. And we will now go back to the top of the agenda and take up House Bill 3211. Witness list. Good morning.
Good morning again.
Mark Landauer and
Mike Faber.
Good morning, Senator Starr, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Thank you for holding a second hearing on House Bill 3211. The City of Portland supports this measure, which would provide tax breaks to landlords who provide low-income housing and also have a contract with a government entity. The purpose, of course, of this legislation is to perhaps encourage landlords to maintain that low-income housing for future years. I've asked Mike Saba with Portland's, who's a senior planner with the City of Portland, to go into a bit more detail. I just would mention a couple things. This measure passed the House 52-0. It has the support of the Oregon Rental Housing Association, the Cities of Eugene, the League of Oregon Cities as well. Thank you very much, and I'll just turn it over to Mike. Thank you.
Excuse me.
Yes.
The bill provides cities with the opportunity to locally decide whether to grant this tax.
That's correct.
So it's not – what we're doing does not grant anybody a tax relief.
That's correct, Senator Starr. What this does is simply pass enabling legislation for local communities to consider adopting this program.
Senator Byer.
Mark, this is just – basically, this is just an expansion of the core area and transit quarters bill. So it's really just a slight tweak to existing law.
That is correct.
Look at that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We close the public hearing, open the work session. Bill 3211.
Bill 3211A to the floor, the Ways and Means.
I think it goes to the floor.
To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moved House Bill 3211 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Adams.
Aye.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator
Starr. Aye. I receive necessary majority. House Bill 3211A and Gross has moved the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Byers will carry. It's easy to get work done when you've got people here to vote. I'm going to make changes for you. Thank you. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2181. Representative Devlin has left. So we will invite Joe Hobson to come forward. This is a public hearing on House Bill 2181.
Oh, this is the tag thing.
Yes, this is a straw. Straw machine.
This is request a DEP, Mr. Shea? No?
No. I think...
Oh, maybe it's changed.
Mr. Hudson, would you tell us about House Bill 2181?
Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Rules and Election Committee, my name is Joel Hobson, Sr. I live in Kaiser, Oregon. I'm here to urge your support for House Bill 2181A and growth. The implementation of Senate Bill 1010 from the last Oregon legislature and its potential for regulatory requirements is a major problem facing Oregon farmers and ranchers. That, along with the several species of salmon being listed as endangered, means it is important that row crop farmers be supported in the use of farm equipment that will address agricultural non-point source pollution and stream restoration.
Excuse me. Let's allow the representative to make his presentation so you go back to work.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll keep my presentation very short. Mr. Hobson came to members of our committee with his proposal. We looked for a bill that was already in the committee with the right relating clause, and we found one that had had one hearing in the committee and we knew was not going to go any farther. And so we wanted to attach his proposal to a bill that basically had no baggage, so we got and stuffed the bill and put his proposal into the bill. The proposal, I think, is a very good one. To extend pollution tax credits to non-point sources. DEQ has told us that in the past they have done that occasionally under rule. They would like more clear direction from the legislature. Also, the program itself, pollution tax credits due to sunset in 2001, and this might be a very good time to get some demonstration of what the impact is of extending it to non-point sources in the final year or two of the program. And it's a very worthwhile proposal, had the unanimous support of the committee, I believe, and very high vote total on the House floor. Appreciate Mr. Hobson bringing it forward to us, and we made a bill that was going nowhere into something that's a good bill that hopefully should be able to make it through the entire process.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I find the presentation to be extremely persuasive. I understand there is some opposition, and perhaps because of time limits, it might be a good idea if we just go to work on this.
I appreciate that. The results of the use of this equipment is very dramatic. And I have seen the results of the application in the neighboring farm in Washington County, and I can attest to its benefits. So we will close the public here and open the work session on House Bill 2181.
Is there any opposition?
There's no witnesses signed up in opposition.
We ask just for the record.
Is there anybody desires to testify on the bill and not? We are in work session.
I'll move the bill, Mr. Chair, to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moved House Bill 2181 A and growth for the due pass recommendation. Ways and means?
Okay.
All right. He has to go to Ways and Means.
Okay. Ways and Means.
Sorry about that. Yes, he needs to go to Ways and Means, apparently. Moved House Bill 2181 to Ways and Means for due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Adams?
Aye.
Senator Byers?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2181A and growth moved to Ways and Means of the U.S. recommendation.
Hold on.
Thank you.
There she is?
Yeah. That's all right. Yeah, we're going to go first. Right. Open a public hearing on, we are now in the subcommittee of the Rules and Elections Committee to take testimony on House Bill 3371. Representative Whip. We Representative Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to give testimony on House Bill 3371. This bill passed the House about 3-4 weeks ago on a, I believe it was a 33-27 vote. What the bill does is it limits the tax on cigars to 65% of the wholesale price up to a maximum of 50 cents per cigar. In our revenue committee, prior to moving this bill to the floor, we had a tremendous amount of testimony from small business owners, typically small retailers that, as part of their business, they sold cigars. And they gave testimony to the tremendous decline that they had suffered in their business following the 1996 initiative that increased taxes on tobacco products. That revenue measure was primarily directed at cigarettes, but what it also did is it put a 65% tax on other tobacco products, including cigars. The effect, it appears that the effect of that increase in taxes has forced many, many consumers of cigars in the state of Oregon to start buying their cigars out of state through the Internet, through mail order, through a variety of means, and has drastically affected the business of these small business owners. On top of that, although I don't have any proof on this point, it appears that the revenue from this increase has actually probably been negative to the state of Oregon. Because instead of capturing the tax revenue from these cigars that were sold in-state, with many of these consumers buying these more expensive cigars out-of-state, they've been avoiding the tax that was levied through the measure. I do not believe that this bill reduces revenues. In fact, I think it will increase revenues over the longer run. I do not believe that this bill encourages smoking. All it says is that it gives a better opportunity for these cigar store owners to sell their products in-state instead of having these customers buy these products out of state. And I do not believe this product in any way feeds an addiction. In fact, tobacco products, cigars, are used differently than cigarettes. What the bill will do, I believe, and I think there will be testimony to support this, is it will protect small Oregon businesses that are in this retail trade. It will also protect Oregon jobs. A number of these small store owners have testified how they've had to lay off employees because of the decline in business following the 1996 measure. And I think it restores a reasonable tax standard to this product that will encourage Oregon consumers to buy these products in state, thus not only protecting jobs and small businesses, but also capturing those tax revenues for the state of Oregon. You know, some people will look at this bill as a controversial bill. I think really it's a common sense bill. I think it certainly makes sense to protect small business in the state of Oregon. And I think this bill does that without hurting revenues from the sale of these products. So for all these reasons, Mr. Chairman, I brought this bill. There was a tremendous amount of testimony and letters and email and other support for this bill. I think if people look at this bill in a rational manner, they will see that it is good public policy. And I would urge, Mr. Chairman, your committee to move this to the floor.
Thank you very much. Still keeping the 65% of wholesale with a further limiting factor being 50 cents per cigar.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
That's all the bill does.
That's correct. Now, some of these expensive cigars, for example, that might sell for $5, for example, the tax on that is 65%, of course, would be $3.50 or $4. When you're buying a box of cigars like that, that's a $100 box of cigar, over $100. The tax on that is $65 or $70. These consumers can avoid that tax by buying the product out of state, mail order, or through the Internet. Avoid the tax. What this bill does is it keeps the 65% in place, but it caps it at a maximum of 50 cents per cigar.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ron McIntyre, James Paul, and Thomas Whitaker.
Good morning, Senator Farr, Senator Beyer. Thanks for being here to take testimony. I was glad that Representative Witt said that this bill is a common sense bill rather than one that is, quote, controversial. And the idea of controversy, of course, arises from the fact that we're talking about a tobacco product, which in the current political climate is taken as something that's bad as strychnine. But it is a legal product, and it is one that people enjoy throughout the United States. They make a free choice to buy cigars, and the reason I came onto this subject is because I enjoy a cigar. This issue is not about cigar smoking or encouraging it, but it's one of pure economics. Representative Witt suggested that there could possibly be a revenue increase to the state which sorely needs revenue. The only reason he said that he thinks that there would be a revenue increase is that the legislative council who analyze these things are not allowed to make a true economic model. They simply do arithmetic. But a reasonable person will understand that if any product is inflated by a 65% attachment to its wholesale price, that the consumer is always going to find an avenue where it's more affordable. I am I guess I could be defined as an average cigar smoker, maybe one cigar a day average. But that's a significant purchase. I smoke $4 to $6 cigars. So you multiply that times 365, and you can see that that's for one person. That's it's an investment, or it's an expenditure in the economy. All of that money that I spend goes out of the state, and I think that is replicated by every single person who buys cigars. This is premium cigars by the box. And it's very easy to do. I dial an 800 number, and FedEx brings the cigars to my house, or UPS. It costs me about $6 to transport those cigars. If this tax modification passes, now I will be buying, going to one of these gentlemen's stores, which is an enjoyable experience for a cigar smoker. You can go into a walk-in humidor, it smells nice, and you can choose your product and spend your money in Oregon. Now I've got, it'll cost me a little bit more because with this, if I buy a box of cigars and the range that I buy them at, the tax will be about $12.50. Which means that I will be contributing $250 a year, just me, to the state's coffers for sorely needed revenue. I did some back of the envelope arithmetic here, and I will bet you, I'll bet you a fine cigar, that if you pass this tax, the state will realize at least $10 million a year in additional revenue. The rate of smoking will not change. The people will be investing their money back in our state. But again, I'll say, if you add a 65% tax, and here's the economics of it. It's not a 65% sales tax. If they buy a box of cigars to put in their store, and if you go to a cigar store, you'll see them open like that, they've already paid the tax on that, so they've had to take that out of their capital. If that product doesn't sell, they're sitting on maybe $100 a box in money that they've already given to the state for a product that nobody buys. So you can see with that kind of an extreme tax that there's some other obvious things going on. Everybody knows it happens, but there is tax avoidance right and left. It's just a natural outgrowth of this thing. There's one other economic issue where I think we'll see more revenue to the state. because there are also extremely high taxes in Washington and California. We know that Californians buy retail Washingtonians and Californians come to Oregon because of, we don't have a sales tax. And we know there's about $30 billion in gross sales in retail every year because of that. That is the same economic issue that we are addressing here. What I will do is defer to some tobacco shop owners. We have about 25 individual stores on our list, people that are hanging on by their nails. Some of them aren't going to make it, and there is absolutely no reason for this other than the fact that this tax was enacted by the voters in a ballot measure that never talked about cigars. It was exclusively, that whole discussion on ballot measure 44 was solely about cigarettes. There were 27 voter pamphlet arguments in favor of ballot measure 44, and not one of them mentioned cigars. It was only the evil weed cigarette, and they are mutually exclusive. I thank you for allowing me to speak, and I'll answer questions if you have any.
Any questions?
Senator Sarge, for the buyer, thank you for hearing us today. I happen to write a letter to the governor that spelled out
the record.
I'm Tom Waker from Portland. Thank you. This is a letter I wrote to the governor recently, but I thought it spelled out very, very clearly what our position is and what this current tax is doing in this state. To the governor, I'm sending this letter to you to demonstrate that the current tax system regarding OTP taxes, and specifically cigars, is costing both the state of Oregon and many Oregon small businesses millions of dollars. HB 3371 is not a bill that deals with tobaccos as much as it deals with business principles in a modern world. Legislators and governors all over the country are perplexed by the lack of ability to tax and govern catalog and internet sales. States with high sales taxes have been plagued by this for years. Controlling sales entities that have neither borders nor boundaries is indeed a modern problem. And at the state level, control is virtually impossible. Because today's consumer has easy access to any retailer in the world with a simple keystroke, Oregon businesses need help to stay competitive. We must be able to maintain marketable goods after the tax is applied. Whether the product is a box of cigars, a pair of shoes, or a wristwatch, if there is a significant savings, the internet or catalog house will have the advantage. The greater the advantage, the greater the savings, there is an exponentially greater exodus of Oregon consumers to these outside sources. With a 65% tax on cigars, it is no wonder that of the some 40 million cigars consumed in Oregon in 1998, only 26.2 million were reportedly sold to Oregon retailers in distribution for resale in the same year. A flyer from the opposition mentioned that if HB 3371 passed, Oregon would be the first state to lower a tobacco tax. I don't know if that's true or not, but I think of this as a positive note, as Oregon has often been the first to implement measures or plans that were responsive to the needs of the state and its people. We should be the first state to react to the modern retail environment where borders are not recognized and alter the tobacco tax to optimize its income and support Oregonians and business at the same time. The net result will most surely be more revenue for the general fund, the Oregon Health Plan, and more business-related revenues from thriving Oregon businesses. I wanted to make one point from another bulleted flyer that we had sent, that nationally cigar sales were up again for the sixth straight year, but not in Oregon. In 1997, 30.3 million cigars were reportedly sold to Oregon distributors, and with a 65% tax bill that related to $5.2 million in revenue, if it was all reported, and we know that a lot of it does not get reported in this way. In 1998, only 26.2 million cigars were sold in Oregon through the same channels, with 4.75 million in taxes supposedly collected at 65%. Consumption in Oregon is approximately 40 million cigars per year, based on some national averages. Had HB 3371 been in effect in either of these years, the tax collected would have equaled 7 to 10 million instead of the 4.6 to 5.2. Consumers are telling us loud and clear they will not pay the tax. Thank you very much.
Questions? Mr.
Meyer. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's hard to put all those numbers in your head. Some
hardly like that. I'm interested in the difference of you're both portraying that there'd be an increase in revenue, yet the analysis that was done by legislative revenue said to offset the loss of revenue based on current sales, as proposed by this tax, would take the sale of an additional 1.5 million cigars to do that. You're suggesting that indeed would happen, and perhaps you would sell 2-3 million?
It'd be more than that, yes. What we're seeing from the national number is that in 1 year, we lost 4 million cigars. Now, we started losing some of this business when the 35% tax was introduced back at the end of the 80s. So mail order started to get a foothold in Oregon back at that time. But we had a dramatic drop once the 65% tax had a chance to sit in. After about 6 months, we saw a great rapid decline.
What's the source of your data?
National Institute Cigar Association, who compiles it through the government agencies, and also they have this report has 96% of all manufacturers, which are all the major ones, reporting their data.
And it's sourced in terms of where the cigars were bought from, or just
all the companies that report to the institute give them the number by sticks that were sold into the state, and they tell them what the value of those sticks were at FOB factory price. So when we have those statistics, those are 96% of all manufacturers reporting. We always have trouble getting information from a few companies, and they're not significant ones. All the major ones are in there.
When your sale was into at the retail end, who bought them, or is it?
No, this is to licensed distributors. In other words, all these major manufacturers are all legitimate. So those numbers don't include, when we talk about 40 million cigars consumed, those include the mail order houses, black market. That makes up the difference between 26.2 and 40 million. We don't want to say realistically that we're going to get all 40 million of those cigars back into Oregon purchased, because you're always going to lose some. Some are going to have been established now with some mail order house, and for whatever reason, that's what they want to do. But if you take the disparity away, if they're not motivated by dollars, and we get it in within $10 of a mail order house, we have most of the Oregonians would like to support an Oregonian. But when it's $60 or $100, they just can't do it. They're not justified.
To kind of amplify what he's saying, I'm on a mailing list. At least this many. These are colorful catalogs from mail order people. They're all 800 numbers. They all have internet. Here is a cigar company that advertised in Oregonian. That's an expensive ad. It was a come on. It says, call us on the 800 number. $15, and there were 9 cigars in the tube. So I couldn't resist that. Got to me within a week. The same cigars in Oregon with the tax would be around $63 or $67 for that. Now, of course, that was a loss leader, but now they've got me, that's the Thompson Cigar Company. So that's the reality of modern economics. Again, I just want to amplify, this is not about smoking. The Willamette Week the other day ran an article and said winners or losers when the House passed 3371, and it said the House has given a tax break to wealthy people, and that's the typical Willamette Week spin, but it's not. The wealthy people, or people that are buying handmade cigars, aren't paying any tax. There's no tax in North Carolina on cigars, or New York, or Tampa, and that's where they come from. So what we're looking for is a chance to do business again in Oregon. We're not talking 90% of the cigars sold in Oregon are the grocery store cigars. We're still talking about the premium ones, where a 65% tax based on the wholesale value just makes it absolutely impossible. Nobody's going to be that stupid, actually, to pay that price when they don't have to.
I'd like to make one point on what Don was saying. There has been some quips about only the wealthy smoking cigars, but I have to say that it's a misconception that premium cigars, which to range without tax from $3 to $20 a piece. Since the beginning of the 90s, premium cigars are enjoyed by people of men and women of all demographics, and it is not a wealthy pastime. Anybody who can go out and afford to have a microbrewery, a nice bottle of beer, can afford to smoke a premium cigar, and do. But as these taxes have hiked these so far up, anybody who wants to buy them buys them elsewhere. And it gets to the point where if the taxes keep escalating on these type of products, then it really is only the wealthy or so wealthy that they don't care about money at all that would buy something in the state.
I have a letter I'd like to introduce into the record. It's from a lady by the name of Kim Jensen, 40-year-old single mom, good solid job, points out that she buys her occasional cigar from a store in Alabama, just to amplify that point.
Thank you.
Jim Paul from Paul's Trading Company. We have several stores in the Portland area. And I can only amplify what both Tom and Don have said, but from a personal standpoint, as far as our business is concerned, we have experienced approximately a 20% drop per year for the last 2 years. We do not sell box sales any longer. Most of the sales that we make are individual cigars. People that come in, and they admittedly will tell you that they are coming in to try a cigar, a new cigar, or a new shape, because they have seen them advertised in the JRs and in the Thompsons, and they want to try them before they order them by email. And it's very simple. I mean, and they're telling me anything that we don't know. We experience this on a daily basis. In addition to that, we have lost some. In our four stores, about 12 people. We've had to reduce our employment by that many people in this period of time from 96 through the present time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Douglas Berry, Steve Rowe, and Jen, looks like Jen Esther Rowe.
Ready for me?
Yes, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator Starr and Senator Beyer, for hearing us. I'm Jan Effler Rowe, Portland, and also a retail cigar store owner. I can only amplify what the gentleman who spoke before me has said. We have cut our staff in half recently, cherry picking my inventory. Right now, as far as tobacco excise taxes, the state owes me money. Inventory. Sales no longer support inventory, so we're making the adjustments, hoping this bill passes, making the necessary steps in case it doesn't. And I have prepared a sheet speaking for all of the retailers. I do want to stress that we 20 Oregon licensed retailers are the state's frontline defense against the blackmail market. We collect the taxes, we sell the product, and it's been made almost impossible to do business in this state because of the excessive taxation on this product. And that's all I have. Do you have any questions?
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Senator Starr, my name is Steve Rowe, Senator Beyer. I am Jan Effler Rowe's husband. We own two stores in Portland. As she has testified, we've had to reduce employment since this tax went into effect. We are small businesses. We are not big businesses. We are trying to meet a need for a market that's in the state, and in fact, this tax has driven this market out of state. As my wife has said many times to customers, we can't exist as a sample shop. We have a shop in downtown Portland. The lease is coming up the end of this year. We'll probably close that store. It's just economics. the onslaught from outside suppliers doesn't stop, I got this in the mail yesterday. This is Indiana. They have a 15% wholesale tax. Plus, then they don't have to pay it to the state when they ship it out of state. This is our survival. Small employers, we just ask for a better chance. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Starr and Senator Beyer. My name is Douglas Berry. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I currently work Tuesdays through Saturdays at Cascade Cigar and Wine, which is the downtown store that Jan and Steve own. On Mondays, I work for Senator Gordley as a legislative assistant. I've done that now for two sessions. I'm not representing Senator Gordley here today, but I'm working on her vote as well. I support House Bill 3371 for several reasons. I think it's an essential fix to ballot measure 44. I think the goals of Measure 44 were to curtail tobacco use and to raise additional revenue for the Oregon Health Plan, and I believe it's failing on both counts. Oregonians aren't smoking fewer cigars. They're simply buying them from other states where the tax isn't so high. I make this observation from my work experience at Cascade and as previous 10 years' work experience as a paralegal in downtown area law firms. You know, it used to be when someone from the office wanted to go get some cigars, they would just walk to the local tobacconist, Cascade or Rich's downtown, and they would buy a box. But that isn't the case anymore. Now it's just an 800 number. They have them delivered to their office, and it's there within a few days. You know, sure, they might come in and they'll buy a stick or two, but then when they want to buy a box, they buy them from out of state. At a 65% wholesale tax, they're literally driven to out-of-state sales. Having worked with attorneys for 10 years, and I don't want to offend anybody here, but even if they do make lots of money, they are some of the, and for lack of a better word, tightest people I know with their money. They're very careful with it. And it's like Mr. McIntyre said, they consider themselves stupid to pay $100 a box tax for 25 cigars. I sell a single cigar, but I lose 25 times that much to an out-of-state retailer like JR or Thompson. I read a letter from one senator stating that he was not swayed by that argument because it is required for those people buying cigars from other states to, quote, self-report and submit the tax. Well, I think that's sheer folly to expect that sort of reporting to take place. The reality is that millions of dollars in revenue are being lost in this fashion, and small businesses are going under. We know of 5 cigar shops that have closed since this tax was increased, and I don't want my job to be next. Since I started at Cascade, I'm the wine buyer there too. Sales of wine have increased 300 to 400%, depending on the month, but that's still not enough. I mean, the markup on wine isn't enough, and those sales increases aren't enough to cover the losses that we've encountered in the cigar sales. I've also heard it bandied about that cigars pose no lesser degree of risk than cigarettes. At best, this is conjecture. At worst, it's absolute bunk. I have there before you copies for you to review of the current literature on the risk of cigar smoking as compiled by Dr. Mark Schneiderman. Personally, I don't understand the hysteria surrounding the tobacco issue. Yes, there are risks associated with cigar smoking, but it is an adult pleasure and an adult choice. When I went on vacation to Italy for 2 weeks, I had no cigars the whole time I was there. I had no opportunity. I was too busy, and everyone there seems to smoke cigarettes, which I personally detest. It's not an addiction to me. I can go weeks at a time. I don't miss it at all. But every once in a while, probably if this still passes, on a special occasion, I'll smoke a fine cigar. I don't like the cheap machine-made ones. I like premium cigars. My favorite cigar retails in Oregon for $18.55. The tax alone on one of those sticks is $4.55. Now, I don't make a lot of money. But right now, Oregon gets 0 cents revenue on those cigars because I don't buy those cigars here. I had a staffer from Governor Kitzhoffer's office ask me, why would the governor want to lower the tax from $4.55 to 50 cents? I said, you don't understand. We're not asking you to lower the tax. We're asking you to modify the tax so that instead of getting 0 cents per cigar, you get 50 cents a cigar. I think that's better. Don't you? The other thing is, you know, on an anecdotal note, my grandmother just turned 80 years old in February. She smoked cigarettes, which is the worst of all, for 60 years. She's alive, and she gets to see her grandchildren and her great-grandchildren. And she's not in the best of health, but she gets around on her own and lives on her own, and she does fairly well. My mother, on the other hand, died 6 years ago at the age of 53. Her problem was she ate too much. She ate too much McDonald's. She ate too much ice cream. She ate too much, period. Now, I don't see any kind of ridiculous excise tax on Big Macs or Whoppers or Lazy Boy chairs and big screen TVs. Can you imagine the lobbyists that would be swarming around the Capitol if those kinds of outrageous taxes were suggested? I mean, a lot of people die from poor diet and sedentary lifestyle, but tobacco seems to be the whipping child of all of this. I've already told you what my point is. Rather than looking at this as a lowering of the tax that some people are talking about, I see it as a way to modify the tax in order to help small business raise the revenue for the health plan and to save my job from the dumpster. Thank you very much.
That's it. Thank you very much. We have State Representative Jim Canope and David Adger. Don Paul here.
Thank you, Chair Starr and Senator Beyer. My name is Tim Canope, State Representative from District 54, and I have with me today a constituent, Dave Hodgert, who owns a specialty cigar store. And he has an interesting story to tell you because he's both a retailer and a wholesaler. I just want to make just a few brief points, and then I would like to let Dave give his testimony. What HB 3371 does is it gives small businesses a chance to compete, just a chance. It saves jobs in my district and probably in yours. Cigar consumption is up in Oregon. However, cigar sales are not, which tells you that the business has gone elsewhere. I think HB 3371 will provide more money to the state of Oregon. The reason I believe this is because cigar smokers don't stop smoking just because of the unusually high Oregon taxes. They just simply go out of state, as it's already been said. If Oregon continues the current policy, it will put many of these specialty cigar stores out of business, and the tax revenue will decrease to the state. But just the cigar tax alone is not the revenue that I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the revenue that's lost in terms of the tax on the profit, the income, and the payroll, because those are significant taxes as well. So the state also loses those, because with those jobs go those taxes. They just disappear. This bill is not about overriding a voter-approved ballot measure, has been stated. There was no debate about whether or not premium cigars ought to be taxed at a higher rate. It's about saving jobs, and it's about small business. And I'd really like for Dave Hodger to tell his story, and I think it's pretty compelling.
Good morning, Senators. Thank you for taking the time to listen to us and have me explain our position or my position on House Bill 3371. I think I'm going to be able to answer Senator Byers.
For the record,
oh, I'm sorry. My name is David Hodgert. I'm the founding partner of Specialty Cigars International in Bend, Oregon. I think I'm going to be able to answer Senator Byers' question that he asked earlier. Where does the data come from about what cigars and how tax increases can change the sales in a particular state? My company is made up of two parts. The first part is the retail store that we own in downtown Bend, Oregon. The second part is our wholesale cigar service, which we provide and service to nearly 6,000 different accounts across the United States. I'm here to talk about my retail shop in Bend, but I have to use my wholesale shop as an example of what's happening to the Oregon retail shops right now. I'll give you a little bit of background about what the wholesale division does. When you go to a golf course in New York, you may see our cigar, see our humidors with cigars in it. When you go to downtown Atlanta, stay at Marriott, you may see our cigars and our humidors that we provide for them there. If you go to Minnesota and you stop for gas, you may see our humidor at a convenience store at the counter. Or if you have a friend that lives in California or possibly New Jersey or any of the other 50 states besides Oregon, I include Washington, D.C. with that, he or she may call me to have cigars sent directly to their house. The question would be, why would anybody call another place, another business, hundreds or thousands of miles away to when surely there is a very fine retail cigar shop within only a few miles of where they live? Simply, they're attempting and succeeding to avoid the state excise tax that their local cigar shop must pay. I'm talking about all 50 states. The law requires in every state that the receiver of the product, in this case, cigars, must pay the tax required by that particular state. While that is good for my wholesale division, because I have 50 other states, including Washington, D.C., calling me, it is terrible for my retail shop, which is what we're talking about, not only for me, but for the rest of Oregon. My retail shop cannot compete with companies that are sending cigars into Oregon and not charging the 65%. What you have ahead of you is a list of the tax rates for all for the 51 different taxes that are out there. The 10 highest states, excluding Oregon, which so we'll go down to number 11, which is Nevada, at 30%, make up 57.5% of my overall gross sales for the year. The interesting part of our data shows, in 1999, an increase of 20% gross sales from California over the same period of 1998. Now, what happened in 99 that is different from 98? January 1, California raised their tobacco taxes from 26% to 61%. My business, my wholesale division business, increased by 20%. For no other reason, we did no other marketing, nothing else into there, except that people were then avoiding the tobacco tax. On July 1, it will increase to 67%. I expect my California cigar sales to increase once again because California cigar lovers are not willing to pay the high tax either. The correlation is similar to Oregon. I bet that if you ask the California company what happened when we, Oregon, raised our taxes to 65% in 1996, their out-of-Oregon state cigar sales jumped because Oregon residents are not willing to pay the excessive tax. I am handing out, you have a sheet, and I think that explains it in black and white. 57.5% of my business from the high tax state. If you look at the low tax states, that's a very, very small amount of my business. If we continue to keep our Oregon tax at 65%, we will be generating millions of dollars for out-of-state business. Why would we do that? I encourage us to keep Oregon money here in Oregon. Let me and the other legal small businesses compete with these out-of-state businesses by changing the way we tax cigars. Also, let me interject one other issue. It has been stated that we are trying to give the rich, yuppie cigar lover a tax break. We are doing no such thing. They are taking a tax break already by ordering cigars from outside the state. What we are doing here is simply trying to keep revenue inside the state of Oregon and keep small businesses, small retail businesses like mine, open, providing jobs, supporting the Oregon economy, and putting food on the table for our families. This bill is not about tobacco. It is about small business survival. It's time to stop the excessive taxing. It is time to support the economy of Oregon and the people who live here.
I'm asking you to let retail businesses like mine compete on a level playing field. I ask you to send House Bill 3371 to the Senate floor. Thank you for your time. Do I have any questions?
Thank you.
Well, my name is John Paul. Along with my brother and dad, we own four stores, tobacco stores in the Portland area. And I just want to reaffirm what my dad said previously and to just say that we've lost virtually all our box sales out of state, and it has cost us jobs at our four stores. Thank you for hearing us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Novick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Byer, Tom Novick, I represent Oregon Health Leadership Against Tobacco, which is a coalition of the Cancer, Heart, and Lung Association. Folks were very active on ballot measure 44. We're opposed to House Bill 3371 for a few reasons. It's been stated that ballot measure 44 had nothing to do with raising cigar taxes. Well, in fact, our folks who wrote it specifically raised taxes not only on cigarettes, but on all tobacco products. It was in the ballot measure for anybody who wanted to read it. Voters did approve that. So by lowering the tax, we will be rolling back a voter approved tax. There's no dispute on that. The revenue impact, although the previous speakers have all said that this will gain revenue for the state of Oregon, it's interesting to note that the Legislative Revenue Office says it's an indeterminate tax loss, and that, in fact, in order to even be revenue neutral, we'd have to sell 1,500,000 additional cigars in Oregon just to be revenue neutral. It's unknown whether or not this will cost the state money. As been stated earlier, Oregon would be the only state in the country this year to reduce tobacco taxes. When you look at California and Washington, we're right roughly in the middle. The state of Washington taxes cigars at 74.9% of wholesale, I believe. The state of California is now at 61.4, going up in the near future. We don't believe it's a good policy. We're not sure that it will generate more revenue. In fact, we think it may reduce revenue. Finally, one of the reasons that tobacco taxes were raised in Oregon, in addition to funding the health plan, there's a direct correlation in all studies that you look at between raising the price and consumption. We've seen cigarette consumption go down significantly in the state of Oregon. And so in closing, we would think that adoption of 3371 would be bad policy.
Do you disagree that the change in consumption or purchase, the change in purchase patterns from box sales to individual cigars is an indication of reduced consumption or just a shift in purchase practices?
Once again, since the Legislative Revenue Office doesn't keep the same records that apparently the cigar manufacturers do, it's tough for them to figure that out. I would make one other point, which is 90% of the cigars sold in the state are not the premium cigars, and what this bill does is retains a 65% tax on those. So people who smoke cheap cigars will still be paying the 65% tax. Those who smoke premium cigars, if they are buying the cigars in Oregon, in fact, will see a significant decrease.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Senator Byer, my name is Larry Harvey. I apologize for not having the opportunity to sign up before, but I just have a few very brief comments here. I represent the American Cancer Society. I have listened with great interest both in the House committees as well as on the House floor and to the testimony here today. The American Cancer Society, we can just say simply straightforward for the record, is opposed to House Bill 3371. I would submit to you that for some reason, it's just me, but some of the logic with regard to the need for this bill has been lost on me, and I'll just cite a couple of different circumstances. I also want to preface these remarks with the fact that I am an empathetic small business owner. I have been for many years. I've never been known in the 13 years that I've been in this building to lobby for higher taxes or to repress or suppress business. So it is not as though I am interested here in curtailing entrepreneurial business opportunities in the state of Oregon. The fact is that the logic of reducing this tax to a certain level would capture revenue doesn't seem to logically follow. That would suggest that if, in fact, as a small business owner, I have the opportunity of paying all of my business taxes or less of my business taxes or none of my business taxes, that for some strange reason, I would just choose to pay only 50% of my business taxes as opposed to none. I'm not that dumb. I would probably choose to pay none if that were an option. Why would I want to pay any at all if, in fact, I'm given the option to avoid paying a tax altogether? Hence, suggesting that we're going to capture a revenue stream that has been lost because folks can buy a product out of state with no tax is fails on me. It's just I'm kind of lost. To suggest that this is not about tobacco would be similar to suggesting that alcohol beverages and taxes on beer and wine are not about beer and wine. The regulation of other substances and products in the state is not about the product. It really is about the end result, and the end result is that we know, scientifically speaking, that tobacco kills people. Using tobacco, whether it is for your own consumption or whether it is a result of secondhand smoke, kills people. It is a legal product. But we do have a number of legal products, both regulated and unregulated, in the state of Oregon that also kill people. And we've heard much debate in this building, just during this legislature, about making certain that people are safe, whether it's from secondhand smoke, firsthand smoke, guns, drunk driving, or any other social issue. In the final analysis, what we have here is a situation where we're suggesting that investing in something that goes up in smoke is a good investment. The only other thing that I know of that we invest in something that we automatically burn is firewood. We're really talking about fine cigars. I would concur with the statements made by Mr. Novick that, in fact, all we've done is maintain a tax on a lower-income product. I am a former cigar smoker, and I've never paid $20 for a cigar because I can't afford it. So we're simply maintaining a tax on a lower-end type of product and eliminating the tax on a higher-end type of product. In view of the fact that there has been some compelling arguments, but that entirely lack any scientific data that could prove that cigar smokers are different from cigarette smokers, no scientific data to suggest that, in fact, the revenue sources and streams would be different if we change the way we operate now in this state, and that, in fact, we're going to be saving jobs. I'm not certain that we would necessarily save jobs. I certainly am not interested in losing jobs, but again, in the collective wisdom of a number of legislative assemblies prior to this one, we've made a number of decisions that have cost jobs, timber jobs and other agricultural jobs, in view of the fact that we need to do something to preserve our environment. Jobs are important. We should do lots to save jobs and put people to work and help families to feed their children. I don't know how many Oregon families would be saved through this, but I'm suggesting here again that this is not necessarily just construed or shouldn't be construed as a small business issue. There's no scientific data to support some of the statements that have been made, and I would urge you to hold this bill in committee until scientific data can be produced to, in fact, compel you to move the bill out to the floor so that we at least there would be some rational reason or logic behind this proposal. Thank you.
Questions? No questions. Thank you very much. We have had very compelling evidence, I think, that this is a small business issue, that it's about tax avoidance by buying out of state over the internet, by toll-free numbers or whatever. We have
subcommittee only of the committee. I'm going to recess this committee until 3 o'clock today, which time I hope I can have a committee on hand. We will take up at that time this bill, perhaps, and likely 3609. With that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 3371 and recess the Committee on the Rules and Elections until 3 o'clock today.